Hello, it is Thursday, June 18th. Welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Andrew Jung. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index hit a record high again, crossing the 9,000 mark for the first time. More on that on News Briefing. On today's in-depth news analysis, we'll sit down with Michael Dunford, the country director for Myanmar at the UN World Food Program, to discuss the worsening food crisis in the Southeast Asian country. Plus, on Explore Korea, we will be joined by An Jae-woo, who will share details of an artist who poses the fundamental question, who am I? All that and more on Korea 24. The Korea Composite Stock Price Index crossed the 9,000-point threshold for the first time on Thursday, turning a new page in South Korea's capital market history. Amid a semiconductor-driven rally, a growing number of brokerages are forecasting that the KOSPI could eventually reach 10,000 points. Our KBS World Radio News reporter, Pae Joo-yeon, joins us in the studio to give us the latest on this story and other headlines of the day. Hello, Joo-yeon.
Hello, Andrew.
The benchmark KOSPI surged more than 2% to cross the 9,000 mark for the first time Thursday. I understand that the milestone came just 34 days after the index first crossed the 8,000 intraday mark.
That's correct, Andrew, or after 22 trading sessions. The index rose 199.6 points or 2.25% to close at a record high of 9,063.84. The KOSPI has gained more than 4,000 points so far this year. After starting the year at 4,000.63, the index crossed the 5,000 mark on January 22nd and the 6,000 mark on February 25th, before going on to surpass 7,000 on May 6th and 8,000 on May 15th.
I suspect that the semiconductor stocks were leading the rally again. Is that correct?
That's correct. Samsung Electronics jumped 4.62%, reclaiming the 360,000 won level, while SK Hynix surged 6.51% and briefly topped 2.7 million won for the first time during intraday trading. Market sentiment remained resilient despite overnight losses in all three major U.S. stock indexes after the June meeting of the U.S. Federal Reserve's Federal Open Market Committee, the outcome of which was seen as unexpectedly hawkish. Investor sentiment was also supported by a significant easing of geopolitical concerns after U.S. President Donald Trump signed a memorandum of understanding with Iran aimed at ending hostilities between the two countries.
Let's now talk about this MOU. The two countries signed it on Wednesday. With the preliminary deal now in effect, the two sides have begun a 60-day negotiation period toward this final agreement. Tell us more.
U.S. President Donald Trump signed a preliminary peace agreement with Iran at the Palace of Versailles on Wednesday, just ahead of a dinner hosted by French President Emmanuel Macron. Iranian state TV on Thursday also aired photos of President Masoud Pezeshkian signing the initial deal with the U.S. The 14-point MOU released by the U.S. government includes immediate and permanent termination of military operations on all fronts, the full reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, and the lifting of a U.S. blockade of Iranian ports.
Did the MOU say whether tolls will be charged for passage in the Strait of Hormuz? We had discussed yesterday, of course, how the two sides were at odds over this.
The MOU states that Iran will make arrangements using its best efforts for the safe passage of commercial vessels with no charge for 60 days only.
So no mention on what the arrangement will be after 60 days.
No more details were mentioned earlier this week, though Trump had said that the critical waterway will open toll-free, but Iran is indicating that after 60 days, it may charge service fees for ships passing through the strait. Tehran's chief negotiator Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf told Iranian media on Wednesday that the Strait of Hormuz will not return to pre-war conditions despite the peace deal. This is what he said.
During the war, I wrote in a tweet that the Strait of Hormuz would never go back to the way it was before, and I still hold that view today. That does not mean, however, that we intend to disregard international law or established rules of navigation.
If Tehran charges fees after 60 days, that will be a concern for South Korea since it relies on the Middle East for over 70% of its crude oil imports, making the Strait of Hormuz a critical energy artery. The Iran MOU also includes a $300 billion U.S. private reconstruction and economic development fund for Iran, amid media reports suggesting involvement by South Korean, Japanese, and Singaporean companies.
I understand that Trump met with President Lee Jae-myung at an official gala dinner attended by G7 leaders in Evian, France. What did the leaders discuss?
According to the Office of National Security on Thursday, Lee congratulated Trump on the end-of-war agreement reached with Iran. The office said the two leaders agreed on the importance of free and safe navigation in the Strait of Hormuz and concurred that the restoration of stability and peace in the Middle East can be expected to stabilize oil prices and the economy.
People might be wondering, however, whether or not these two leaders discussed any topics other than the Middle East situation.
They discussed Korean Peninsula issues. He conveyed his hopes that Trump will play a role in finding a peaceful solution to the North Korea issue, just as he strived to resolve issues in the Middle East. In response, Trump reportedly said he will play a necessary role for the progress of the Korean Peninsula and communicate closely with Lee on related matters. The top office said Trump called Lee a strong leader and that the two were able to confirm their special friendship and trust during their exchanges throughout the G7 event. President Lee returned home on Thursday after a 10-day tour that took him to Belgium, the European Union, Italy, the Vatican, and the Group of Seven summit.
Now, let's turn to the latest on the ballot shortages that occurred during last Wednesday's local elections. A special parliamentary committee has launched Operation Thursday to shed light on the unprecedented incident. Juyeon, tell us more.
A special probe committee held its inaugural meeting on Thursday, kicking off a 45-day parliamentary investigation on the ballot shortages. The plan for the parliamentary inquiry, approved during the meeting, was adopted at a plenary session of the National Assembly later in the day. The committee comprises 9 members from the ruling Democratic Party, 7 from the main opposition People Power Party, and 2 from non-negotiating parties. The National Election Commission has acknowledged that at least 26 polling stations nationwide experienced temporary shortages of ballot papers on Election Day.
This is a story that's been rattling the country for several weeks now. What do we know about the scope of the committee's investigation?
The probe aims to determine how the ballot shortages occurred, evaluate the adequacy of the calculations of the number of ballots printed, examine the relevant guidelines, and assess the NEC's on-site management on Election Day. It will also investigate when the NEC became aware of the ballot shortages and consider any infringements of voter rights arising from the temporary suspension of voting that resulted.
Let's now get some World Cup stories. South Korea's national football team will face Group A leader and host Mexico on Thursday local time, which is Friday, of course, here in South Korea, in their second match of the 2026 FIFA World Cup. Juyeon, what can you tell us?
South Korea and Mexico will meet Thursday local time in what amounts to a battle for first place in Group A after both sides opened the tournament with wins. The winner will advance directly to the round of 32. At an official pre-match press conference, manager Hong Myung-bo said preparations were complete and that his players were in peak condition. Let's listen to what he said.
The starting lineup has been decided. The players are feeling good about their condition. We reached the semifinals at the 2002 World Cup. I hope our players can go beyond that record.
Hong acknowledged that the match will be played in front of an overwhelmingly pro-Mexico crowd, but said he expects his experienced squad to handle the pressure. This marks South Korea's 12th FIFA World Cup campaign.
Hong Myung-bo, of course, was a player on that 2002 squad. But how many times has South Korea advanced to the knockout rounds?
The Taeguk Warriors have progressed to the knockout rounds 3 times, highlighted by a historic semifinal run in 2002 with round of 16 finishes in 2010 and 2022. South Korea had their final training session on Wednesday at the Chivas Verde Valle Training Center in Zapopan near Guadalajara. Having opened the tournament with a come-from-behind win over Czechia, South Korea will look to extend its winning streak to 2 and create momentum by taking down host nation Mexico. After the Tiger Warriors faced Mexico, the next match will be against South Africa at Estadio Monterrey in Guadalupe next Wednesday, local time.
That's it for today's news briefing. Thank you, Gian.
Thanks, Andrew.
Myanmar faces one of the gravest hunger emergencies in the world, driven by armed conflict, economic collapse, and a long, fragile recovery from a 7.7 magnitude earthquake last year. The ongoing war in the Middle East has worsened the crisis in the Southeast Asian country by pushing up food, fuel, and fertilizer prices, leaving one in four people, roughly 12.4 million, facing acute food insecurity and struggling to meet their basic needs. This week's tentative peace deal between the United States and Iran provides a small measure of hope, but the prolonged conflict has already taken a heavy toll. To help us better understand the situation in Myanmar, we are joined in the studio by Michael Dunford, the country director for Myanmar at the United Nations World Food Program, who is in Seoul to raise awareness. Welcome to the show, Mr. Dunford.
Thanks very much, Andrew.
I know that Myanmar is possibly one of, if not the most, overlooked stories in our world, a forgotten tragedy of sorts. For our listeners, could you outline the current food insecurity situation in Myanmar and how serious that is?
The population in Myanmar are under enormous strain. Ever since the military coup back in February 2021, humanitarian needs have continued to rise. Back in that time, there was only 1 million people requiring humanitarian assistance. Today, that number is over 16 million, of which the vast majority are acutely hungry. There are another 3.7 million people internally displaced within the country. You put all of these factors together, over a quarter of the population needs support, but unfortunately, because of a lack of funding, the international community is not yet able to meet those needs.
16 million. That is about a third of the population here in South Korea. How has food insecurity affected people's daily lives? Could you give us some examples to put this into context so that ordinary people can understand better?
Sure. I think it is touching every facet of their lives. You know, parents are unable to provide the basic food needs for their children. Parents are regularly having to go without food. There isn't enough food necessarily in the market. What is in the market is often beyond the reach because it's too expensive. This has an impact on the nutrition status, and there are now over 400,000 children who are acutely malnourished, unable to get the basic nutritional needs to allow for a proper life. It's a devastating situation. People are skipping meals. People are going without. The situation is gradually getting worse. And the problem is that it has now been running for over 5 years. So many people are having to scavenge for food in the forest. People are going without, and it's a devastating situation for them.
So sounds like scenes that might have been observable in this country maybe 70 or 80 years ago, and every parent or anyone who has experience raising a child might be able to imagine how painful it is to not be able to feed that child properly. Can you tell us more about the main factors driving the hunger crisis here, or not here, but there in Myanmar?
Sure. So the major driver is an ongoing conflict, a civil war between the military and multiple ethnic armed organizations across the country. It's estimated there are somewhere between 30 and 40 different armed organizations that are fighting the center. And this conflict continues to get even worse. We've seen increased aerial bombardments. We've seen increased attacks on civilian populations. This is driving displacement either internally, as I mentioned, 3.7 million people internally displaced, which means they've lost all of their coping mechanisms that typically come from where they live. And many others have been forced to seek protection internationally, crossing borders into places like India, Thailand, China, and others.
Well, it's never fun to leave home. Leaving home in that kind of situation is unimaginable. How is the ongoing conflict in the Middle East affecting the hunger in Myanmar? Is that, well, obviously making that worse, but how worse?
Well, yeah, we're yet to see exactly how bad it will become. Certainly prices are on the increase. There has been fuel rationing introduced because the authorities were very concerned at the beginning of the Middle East crisis that there was a risk the country could run out. It means that people have been unable to access all the fuel they need, particularly the farmers. So there's been a reduction in the mechanization of the farming this year. There has also been a less uptake of fertilizers because those prices have spiked. So we will see come the harvest just how bad it is. But some preliminary indicators suggest that somewhere between 1.5 and 3 million additional people could be acutely hungry because of the Middle East. And that's playing out all over Asia presently and globally. The global estimate is that the conflict in the Middle East could add an additional 45 million people to the global numbers, which are already over 300 million people acutely hungry.
45 million. That's another humbling figure. The population here is around 50 million, so 45 million is certainly not very small.
So potentially the entire population of the Republic of Korea could be hungry in addition to what is already the case around the world.
And can you describe what acutely hunger actually means? Because for, I guess, most of our listeners, they might not be able to differentiate, you know, just being hungry and acutely hungry.
No, well, it means that there is insufficient food to meet basic needs on a sustainable basis. It means that people are being forced to compromise, adopt negative coping mechanisms, skipping meals, eating meals that don't offer the basic nutrients and protein. And that has a debilitating effect over an extended period of time. We're very concerned at the World Food Programme as to what's happening in Myanmar. We're concerned about what's happening globally. The number of people acutely hungry has almost doubled since 2019. And that's the impact of COVID, first and foremost, and the disruption that that caused to the world economy and to world supply chains, forcing many into hunger, and then constant conflicts. And we see them not only in Myanmar, but in Gaza, and in Ukraine and Sudan and many other places in the world. We desperately need an end to those conflicts before the situation will start to right itself.
Well, the World Food Program is designed, or is supposed to, help out and alleviate some of the pain that you've described. How is the World Food Program exactly helping in Myanmar combat this hunger crisis? And what kind of assistance in detail are you providing?
So we have a variety of different types of programs. Predominantly, we're focusing on meeting humanitarian needs. So effectively, life-saving activities, providing basic food to the most desperately vulnerable. In addition to that, we are providing support at the school level with school meals to attract and hold children in those schools. We also work on nutrition programs. And we're supporting people with HIV and TB, so those who, because of their particular conditions, are increasingly vulnerable. So it's a substantial program. It's certainly not as large as I would like to see it, and that ultimately comes down to levels of funding. We can expand our programs, but we need the funding to be able to do so.
Other than funding, some of the challenges that you've mentioned include the violence going on in Myanmar. What other challenges does the WFP face in delivering aid across Myanmar?
So the biggest one is having the humanitarian access, having the scope and the permissions necessary to reach populations wherever they may be within the country. You've mentioned the conflict. Yeah, that also limits our ability to reach people where they need. There are bureaucratic impediments. We need to request permissions from the authorities to move commodities into different parts of the country. We provide programs either in-kind food, where we're providing different types of ingredients, be it rice, oil, lentils, or we provide cash. And the beauty of providing cash is that the recipients, the beneficiaries, are able to then make choices what they spend that food on. Oh, sorry, that money on, and what are the types of food that they most need to meet their basic needs.
South Korea is one of the top 10 donors to the WFP. How does South Korea's contributions help address the crisis in Myanmar, and what role has that played?
As you say, Korea has been one of WFP's best supporters, not only in Myanmar, but globally over the last few years. And we're greatly appreciative, not only of the government, but of the people of Korea in this regard. They have been one of our most regular and consistent donors. So we know that funding will be coming and we can start to plan accordingly. They are supporting us both with our humanitarian activities, but also through COICA, we're starting to explore opportunities to help communities and the households with resilience building. We don't want to just meet immediate humanitarian needs, but we want to help communities invest in their own longer-term capacity to feed themselves. And so the support we're receiving through different channels within from Korea is making a big difference.
You mentioned funding as a critical need. What other venues are you exploring to meet that need?
So traditionally, most of the funding that WFP receives comes from governments, be it the government of Korea, Australia, the US, and others. But that's not enough. Unfortunately, given current circumstance, a lot of governments are actually reducing their funding to WFP and others. So we're looking to see how we can leverage the private sector. Many private sector companies, including here in Korea, have philanthropic or CSR motivations. And so we're in conversation to see how they can invest and what they're particularly interested in. How can we leverage their expertise in addition to their funding? And so there's some good conversations that we're having, and we'll continue those over the course of the next couple of days.
How big is this financial gap? Are we talking tens of millions or hundreds of millions or perhaps billions with a B?
Yeah, unfortunately, at the global level for WFP, we probably have needs in the range of about $13 billion. And this year, I think if we're fortunate, we might reach between $6 and $7 billion. So perhaps half of our overall requirements will be short. In Myanmar itself, we have a budget of $125 million that we would like to raise. And if I manage to raise some, you know, $70, $80 million, I'll be happy, because that's a substantial amount of money, but it is far below what we would like and what is required if we were to support all the people we intend.
Before we wrap up, do you have any final messages that you would like to leave with our listeners?
I think the key is that people should not forget about Myanmar, and particularly the people of Myanmar. They have been subjected to extraordinary hardship over the course of the last 5 years. They are extremely resilient. They're a wonderful people, but they can't continue to meet their needs by themselves. The World Food Programme and others are there supporting, but we need financial support from the government of Korea, from the private sector in Korea, and even from the population of Korea. But we need to keep Myanmar front and center on decision makers' minds, because Myanmar deserves our support. The support can be provided, but it comes with a cost. And that's what WFP is desperately trying to achieve, the funding requirements, so that we can operate at the levels to meet the needs in Myanmar.
Well, this country was in a similar situation, again, 70, 80 years ago. That was when this country also received the generous aid of many other countries outside Korea. So it would be very noteful for everyone listening to remember the plight of millions of ordinary people in Myanmar who did not do anything to deserve the fate that they are in. But that's it for today's in-depth news analysis. That was Michael Dunford, the country director for Myanmar at the United Nations World Food Program. Thank you for your time today, sir.
Thanks very much.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 199.6 points, or 2.25% on Thursday, to close at a record high of 9,063.84. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ lost 31.03 points, or 3.01%, to close at 1,000.93. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets, handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Andrew.
So, what's our first story today?
We begin with an update on a story we covered on our previous edition of Korea Trending, a human leg that was found discarded at a recycling facility in Incheon.
That was certainly a gruesome story. What is the latest on that leg, and what have investigators found out so far?
The Incheon Yeonsu Police Station investigating the origin of the left leg found on June 10th at a public facility that processes recyclable materials in Incheon's Yeonsu District provided some updates. On Thursday, the official said there's high probability that it was discarded medical waste.
You know, I used to live there in Yeonsu, and obviously I would have been horrified if I still was there, and the people there are probably very horrified. But I guess it's a bit of a relief then, right? If that turns out to be the truth, no murder, no foul play, just a huge, gruesome mistake. But if it is medical waste, it likely came from a hospital. Did any hospital reach out to the authorities after the discovery?
Yes, actually. In fact, a nursing hospital in Incheon told police that the leg may have come from their hospital. The leg is believed to have been amputated from a woman in her 80s who was being treated at a hospital after necrosis developed in her left leg.
But we still are left scratching our heads. Did anyone provide some type of explanation on how that leg ended up at a recycling center?
The hospital reportedly said the amputated leg had been disposed of as medical waste, but a cleaning staff member mistook it for part of a mannequin used to practice applying cast and sorted it as recyclable waste.
A huge mistake there. What's the next step in the police investigation?
Well, they will review the results of an emergency DNA analysis by the National Forensic Service and check CCTV in the hospital to cross-check the information provided by the hospital side. The focus will now be on determining what kind of medical waste disposal rules the hospital violated and what went wrong during the disposal process and what caused the cleaning staff to mistakenly dispose of the leg.
Hoping everything stays fine in Incheon. But let's move on to our next story, Dan.
New data finds that more than 19 million people have been affected by the personal information leak at the South Korean over-the-top or OTT platform TVing that occurred back on June 2nd.
You know, it seems like there's some type of leak literally every 2 or 3 months, and all of them sound very big. But we've grown so numb to them that it fails to raise alarms. How bad was this one on TVing?
Based on materials acquired by a Democratic Party lawmaker on Thursday from the Personal Information Protection Commission and the Ministry of Science and ICT, the data breach affected 19.5 million people. That's nearly fourfold the 5 million TVing paying members.
That is huge. What kind of information was compromised?
So the data breach compromises not only names and dates of birth, but also passwords, bank account numbers for refunds, connecting information, and duplication information. The incident shows concerning degree of lax management of user info by domestic OTT platforms. Also, reportedly, more than 90,000 affected users applied to join a civil lawsuit seeking damages.
As I said, these leaks are happening so frequently that each new leak fails to register with us at the proper level of seriousness. So what are the authorities and regulators saying about preventing future leaks?
Well, first of all, the company that's at the center of it all, TVing, said it will do its best to provide relief to victims and vowed to actively cooperate in joint public-private investigation. The government is looking to devise institutional measures to prevent recurrence.
Hardly reassuring. But now to our final story. What do you have for us, Dan?
Nationwide downpour in Korea is forecast from Friday through the weekend, but weather authorities say this does not mark the official start of the monsoon season.
So heavy nationwide rain forecast for the next several days, but not yet the monsoon season. What's going on? What did the weather agency say about this?
Well, the Korea Meteorological Administration explained that while heavy rain advisories could be issued as concentrated downpours fall mainly in the southeastern region, the phenomenon cannot be seen as the start of the monsoon season. Apparently, this is because a stationary front must continuously affect Korea, but the current situation is temporary.
Did the KMA provide any indication about whether this year's monsoon season will come earlier or later than usual?
Well, based on past records, monsoon season begins slightly past mid-June in the southern Jeju Island. Well, last year, Korea saw the season come earlier than anticipated. This year, it is forecast to arrive later, mainly due to blocking phenomenon which occurs when large-scale high-pressure systems, drier intrusions, or anomalous jet streams patterns halt the advance of rain-bearing monsoon winds.
But we are still expecting a rather rainy weekend. What should those people in Korea or those planning to visit be prepared for?
Well, brace for nationwide precipitation on Friday beginning on Jeju Island, and strong rain is expected in central regions excluding the greater Seoul area in the southern regions, raising the possibility of heavy rain advisories there. Rain will gradually clear in most regions from late Saturday afternoon, but it is expected to continue in eastern Gangwon until Sunday morning. After the rain stops, mostly cloudy weather will continue next week.
Hoping everyone stays safe, but that's all we have for today's Korea Trending segment. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hello, everybody. My name is B-Boy Phil Wizard, and I am the breaking gold medalist from the Paris 2024 Olympic Games, and you are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
It's time now for our weekly segment, Explore Korea, where we uncover hidden stories and experiences from around the country. Joining me today is An Jae-woo, our regular contributor here, and an old friend with whom I'm happy to be reunited with on the same show again. Hello again, Jae-woo.
Thank you for the kind words, and very much likewise, Andrew.
Yes. What are we talking about this week?
Okay, so today we're going to talk about an artist whose subject matter, especially in the more recent years, has been a philosophical question which I believe many, if not all, of us, and definitely myself, perpetually ask, right? It's a very simple question, although very, very tough to answer, the question that goes, who am I? Yes, the ancient Delphic maxim, know thyself, of course, popularized by Socrates, is arguably the most famous philosophical statement of all time. Yet apparently, even to this day, and very likely forever, or at least until the very last day of the existence of an intelligent being somewhere in the universe, answering this question has been and will rather likely continue to remain an unsolved mystery, which implies, especially in the arts, that it can also be the gift which keeps on giving in terms of creative inspiration, the development of comprehension on the self, and even a possible series of transformation. Yes, continuously transforming your efforts in trying to better understand who you actually are and what you can be.
Mm.
Just like the personal history of today's artist, who, well, after a four-year-long hiatus from exhibiting doing solo exhibitions right here in the capital of Korea, well, now she's come back in the Seoul art scene with a solo exhibition which shows the very latest of her nonverbal responses to the millennia-long question. So, Andrew, today we'll explore this rather profound artist, Chung Bo-kyung.
Well, Jae-woo, I know you're a very profound person yourself.
I'm not too sure about that.
and I love the way you introduce these artsy venues to us and our listeners.
Thank you.
Also confess, who am I is something I've not found the answer to in my now almost four decades on this planet.
Mm.
So I must ask, to where and when should we go to enjoy the works of Chung Bo-kyung?
Of course. So let's first talk about the title of this interesting exhibition. The title is Outruns Thought. That's right, Outruns Thought. What outruns thought? Let's think about that. Maybe art, maybe our craft, or a whole lot of other things as well. But yes, the title of the show is Outruns Thought. It runs through July 5th, and the venue is an interesting gallery with an interesting name, the OMG Gallery.
Mm.
Now, FYI number one, OMG resides in the Hannam-dong area of the Yongsan-gu district here in Seoul, where Hannam-dong is, of course, part of the so-called Greater Itaewon area, one of the most culturally diverse neighborhoods in Korea. And B, Hannam-dong is also one of Korea's major art districts as well. A healthy number of really high-tier galleries and other varieties of art venues reside in this area. So it's a fantastic place to enjoy a summer gallery crawl. And FYI number two, the acronym OMG in the context of this particular gallery stands for not the usual Oh My God, but OMG, Ordinary Moments Gallery, reflecting the gallery's spirit of making the creation, exhibition, and appreciation of great art into more of an ordinary part of our lives. That said, since their exhibitions are so great, I coined a personal nickname for them, EMG, Extraordinary Moments Gallery. So for more information on this wonderful gallery and the exhibition, please visit omg-kr.com. Once again, that's omg-kr.com, which is, of course, a 100% English speaker friendly website.
I'm more of a Ordinary Moments Gallery type of guy, but happy to refer to the venue as the EMG. But I should stress that visitors who want to be there should not type in EMG their phones, but OMG.
That's right.
Into their phones if they want to search for where it is. And although I don't know who I am, who is Chung Bo-kyung, the artist behind this expedition?
I like how you phrased that question. Very clever. Okay, so let's get to that. Chung Bo-kyung was born in 1982, born and raised here in Seoul. She currently lives and works in the beautiful city of Chuncheon in the Gangwon-do province. And quick side note, is it or is it not June, right? The month of June. Chuncheon in the month of June. Right? It's just an incredibly beautiful city, especially this time of year. Great nature. And oh, let's not forget the great food as well, right? And it's not too far away from Seoul. So do visit for a quick summer breather. But coming back to Chung Bo-kyung, she earned her bachelor's degree from one of the so-called Big Three art schools of Korea, the Fine Art College of Hongik University. She conducted her graduate studies at Hongik as well. And over the past two decades, she's exhibited her works through an uncountable number of exhibitions all across the country, including, check this out, 21 solo exhibitions. So for an artist who's in her mid-40s, already doing 21 solo shows, that's a very, very impressive number right there. And some of her works are in a few noticeable public art collections as well, including the collections of the Chuncheon Culture Foundation, the Gwangju Museum of Art, and the Korea Craft and Culture Association.
I agree with Jae-woo that Chuncheon offers a quick getaway for people living in the Seoul metropolitan area. Beautiful city, 90-minute drive away from Seoul. My wife and I are huge fans of the city, and of course, the Seoul subway is also connected to the city.
I almost forgot about that. That's a great point, yes.
Yes, but I digress. back to Jung Bo-kyung. Tell us more about her craft.
Okay, so Jung Bo-kyung is predominantly a painter. Well, at least in terms of her exhibiting career so far, I will elaborate on what exactly I mean by that in a minute. But in terms of subject matter, now, earlier in her career, she developed fame through her unique style of representing flowers and still life, which, of course, have been popular subject matters throughout the history of painting, right? However, when it comes to that particular subject matter and the early craft of Jung Bo-kyung, two important points. A, popularity in commercial art scene. And what I mean by that is, when you do a not too, so to speak, special or unique subject matter, right, you need really, really something special in terms of your technique to make you stand out. And that's exactly what Jung Bo-kyung was, and still is, of course, in terms of technique. But especially back in the day, it was like, all right, like, for example, if you're a director of a commercial gallery, you're thinking, wow, these works would really sell well, is what you're thinking, right? And they actually did, of course. And then point number two, the uniqueness in terms of technique. What I mean by that is not only was she really good, but she had a very, very unique style. And using the literature of art history or art theory, I think it'd be safe to say that Jung Bo-kyung is an expressionist artist. And expressionism in contemporary art, modern contemporary art, is basically a type of, especially in painting, for example, right? Your brush strokes are really in a way where, you know, when you're the appreciator, you're looking at the work and you're thinking, wow, it's that kinetic energy, right? In the brush stroke, it's like this artist is really trying to express something like their emotions or some kind of an event that happened related to what's being represented, these kind of things, right? Other than, say, for example, a realist painter who would, you know, literally try to be more realistic about their representation, right? Like photographic images, for example. So Jung Bo-kyung, you can, I guess, categorize her as an expressionist painter. However, there's a bazillion number of expressionist painters and visual artists out there. What's so unique about her style is that you just look at the work and you're like, okay, I get that it's probably an expressionist work. Mm. However, it's also so uniquely Jung Bo-kyung, if you know what I mean, right? And another interesting aspect regarding this, and going back to my first point, popularity in commercial art scene, is that when you still have, despite being so unique, this really generally appealing kind of a touch to your craft, then what's going to happen is, oh, okay, so she's really doing her own thing, but it's very appealing to the general public. So again, from a gallerist's point of view, this is the kind of artist that I want to represent, right? Now, that's the first half of her career. And then in the more recent years, what's going on is we see now more serious subject matters, especially her portraits, right? And especially regarding her recent portraits, it has a lot to do with, for example, her way of representing marginalized people, right? And I'm not just talking about, you know, the political / sociological idea of marginalization, like, for example, being marginalized due to race or gender or things of that matter, right? It's just, you know, just everyday people who just seem to be like alienated from enjoying a true happiness and meaning of life, right? Which actually brings us back to that whole philosophical question of know thyself and who am I, right? So now you see with that rather relatively more serious mind-grinding, if you will, when it comes to understanding your subject matter and doing artistic representation, where we are now seeing more powerful, like an even more vivid, an expressionist style of hers, which expresses like the agony and, of course, other ordeals which are associated to marginalization.
Well, I guess as you grow older, you gain more experience, you inevitably become humbled. And you start to notice, you know, the folks who are not as lucky as you are around you. And I guess that possibly had an influence on the work of Jung Bo-kyung. And it never hurts to create sellable material, I guess.
Right.
But maybe her work somehow connects to the big question you posed earlier, Joe. Earlier you said her most recent works are nonverbal responses to the question, again, who am I?
Mm-hmm.
How so?
Okay, so a very important event in her personal history occurred in 2019. Her grandmother passed away, who was a very, very important figure in her personal life. And a few years before that, she became a mother, right? So this is the phase of her life where she's like having this really vivid and personal private experience of what exactly this life and death actually mean, right? You're giving birth to a new life and you're experiencing the death of someone who meant so much to you, right? And then you're aging at the same time. So as you mentioned so eloquently, it's about experiencing all these really profound experiences while you're self-experiencing aging and maturity, right?
Mm.
And then you also begin to raise more mature questions as well. For example, how can I deal with the marginalized self, right? So you're reaching these new realizations, and therefore, as an artist, you're also pondering new ways of practicing art. And going back to her recent, currently running a solo exhibition titled Outruns Thought, what's really interesting about this exhibition is not only in terms of subject matter, but it's that it's 100%, it's 100% monotype.
Mm.
Exhibition, which is not painting, right? Monotype is not a typical painting, but it's a very special type of printmaking, as a matter of fact. And I think we can safely conclude that she's trying this new technique to, in a technical way, to actually approach in a new way this really profound question. And as an art critic, and more importantly, as just an appreciator of art and as a human being, I can tell you that does it answer that profound question? Probably not. But artistically, it inspires us to take at least a few really significant steps closer to reaching our own individual respective answers.
Well, it's a very profound and, I would argue, meaningful exercise. Be sure to check out some of Chung Bo-kyung's works on our Instagram channel, KBS Korea 24. And it's a shame that we have to call it an end for today's Explore Korea, however. Joining us today in the studio was An Jae-woo. And for listeners who may have missed the information on where and how to find the works of Chung Bo-kyung, her exhibit runs through July 5th at the, again, OMG Gallery in Hanamdong. Jae-woo, thank you. Lovely to see you again.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Korea 24, but we'll be back tomorrow. Again, you can always listen to Korea 24 on various apps, KBS Kong, KBS World Radio, and KBS World Radio On Air at 7:10 p.m. Korea Standard Time every weekday. I've been your host, Andrew Jung. As always, thank you for joining us, and goodbye.
KBS World Radio strives to promptly update our listeners on safety procedures during emergency situations. The following are recommended guidelines to follow in case of extreme heat. Prepare fans or air conditioners at your home. The recommended air conditioning temperature during the summer is 26 to 28 degrees Celsius. If you do not have access to air conditioning, make sure that your house is well ventilated. Take a brimmed hat or sunglasses when you go outside, and don't forget to wear sunscreen. Refrain from drinking caffeinated drinks or alcohol. Instead, drink water or sports drinks. Also, do not leave your children or pets in your car with the windows closed, as the temperature can get extremely high inside. If you show symptoms of headaches, nausea, or muscle spasms, immediately move to a cooler place to rest and sip a cold drink. Local governments provide rest areas for people who are outdoors and for those who do not have access to air conditioning. You can find rest areas from the local government's websites. If you need emergency assistance, you can dial 119 for emergency services. Please check our website at world.kbs.co.kr for up-to-date information and procedures.
SBS World Radio.